Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Now, I know this is probably the perfect day for some sort of on-air joke where Virginia pops back onto the mic and makes some sort of big surprise, but this is not a joke. In fact, this hour, I promise that there will be no pranks, no gags, no tricks, just the truth. In celebration of all the mischief that's getting underway today, we are going to be examining the differences between pranks, hoaxes, and cons, starting, as you might expect, with an April Fool's Day prank, which, depending on how you look at it, either went really, really right or really, really, really wrong.
So, Taylor, remember we were talking in the studio about our friend?
Yes.
Or my friend, I should say.
Yes, Brett. His name is Brett, right?
His name is Brett, and yes, we have him on the line right now. I wanted him to tell you the story because I remember it being hilarious, but I thought that you should speak with him directly.
Okay. Hi, Brett.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So, I don't know much about this story. Are you being pranked, or are you the person who committed the prank?
Definitely being pranked.
Ooh, okay. So, this must start with you at some naive point where you don't know what's going on then.
That's exactly right. I was a junior in college, so that's about peak naivety, I believe, looking back on it. I have to admit, I was doing a lot of partying at that point.
Mm-hmm.
My birthday was March 24th, and, you know, obviously April Fool's Day is April 1st. So that basically around that whole time, I was partying pretty hard. And I get home to my house. You know, it's like your standard college house. There's like four of us living there. I get home, and my roommates, all three of them, are sitting in the living room, kind of upset. They look pretty angry.
This is on April 1st?
This is on April 1st.
Okay.
All right, school that day, I had class that day, and then I got home, and this was the situation. And I sit down, and like my closest friend, who was kind of the main roommate, you know, he was dealing with the landlord and stuff. He's like, Brett, we're getting evicted.
Oh, no.
We're getting evicted. And, you know, my face just totally, my heart sinks. And he goes, and it's your fault. And now I'm already in shock. I'm like, we're getting evicted. And it's me. It's my fault. And he pulls out this letter from our landlord. His name was Leroy. And he was already super intimidating. He had drafted this letter up on like formal letterhead saying that, you know, due to the loudness and you're waking up the neighbors and to damage to the property because of the actions of one Mr. Brett Sedell, all of the tenants of the house have to leave. Signed, Leroy. And my roommates, looking back on it, were doing an amazing job of not laughing. I was just flabbergasted, and I had the biggest pit in my stomach. I felt horrible. Now, I get a call from my parents, and they go, you know, we're really, really disappointed in you.
Oh, my God.
Like, really serious stuff. They're like, Joe told us that you got them all kicked out. We're really disappointed in you. We're thinking of maybe even, like, cutting you off. Like, we're sending you to this college, and all you're doing is being loud and obnoxious and breaking stuff.
Wait, okay, hold on. So you didn't get suspicious about the speed with which things were progressing at this point? I mean, you get the letter. Your parents call, what, like an hour later?
Because that's kind of seems like that's when the news came in. Yeah, it seemed like that. The timing seemed natural to me because here it is, April 1st, you know, and I still didn't piece it together. It's April 1st. Rent is due. Instead of rent, I was getting kicked out. I was being evicted, and it was completely my fault. So that's April 1st. You know, that goes into April 2nd. April 3rd, there's a whole other day in between here. April 3rd, I'm packing stuff up, and one of my roommates comes into my room, and he goes, what are you doing? I go, dude, we got kicked out. You know, I'm sorry. Like, I'm packing it up. He goes, nobody told you? Nobody said April Fools at the end of that? No! It was April 3rd. No one had told me at all that this was a joke or a prank in the slightest. I don't think I'd be packing up my belongings on April 3rd had somebody told me 2 days ago like they should have.
You know what's amazing about it is that if you think about an April Fool's Day joke, it's that the whole point is that you reveal the joke. And that's where the humor comes from. It's like you keep silent, you get through it, and then you know, you do the reveal, and it's like they didn't even think about that part.
No, it's like, it's honestly like they forgot, which made it that much funnier. Like, I was really stewing. I was in a rough place for 2.5 days.
Was this a situation where, like, you didn't want to talk to your roommates after? Were you pissed?
Oh, Oh, my goodness, yeah. But it was hilarious. I kind of like, at that point, and even now, I would always choose whatever's funnier. So, yeah, if I could have played it out on one of them, I would have, so I couldn't be too angry. I was only angry because it was painful. My like life had turned around. Like, my friends ate me. My family is upset with me. They're disappointed. So, yeah, I was angry, and then now it's just the best prank that's ever been done to me.
And then did you just, like, unpack your boxes and...
Well, yeah, and then I started partying again. I was like, yes, all right, let's party.
So that's an example of a practical joke going maybe a bit too far. But Brett's story is hardly unique. In fact, pranks have long been a part of human history, stretching across time and cultures. Kembrew McLeod chronicles the history of pranking in his book, Pranksters, Making Mischief in the Modern World. Virginia sat down with him to discuss why we're so drawn to mischief making.
The title of your book is Pranksters, but you divide the mischievousness into three categories: pranksters, hoaxers, and con artists. Why not just use the blanket term pranks? What's the distinction?
Yeah, for me, a prank is public provocation and uses mass media to circulate it in order to make a thoughtful, socially conscious point, as opposed to a hoax or a publicity stunt, which basically uses the same tactics, but the purpose is essentially to either self-promote or make fun of someone else. And then con artists also use the same strategies, but they use the strategies in the service of ripping you off. Yes, they use the same tactics, but for me, you know, I'm not interested in celebrating cruelty. I'm not really interested in that. I'm interested in the kinds of almost performance art-esque provocations that turn the world askew so that you can sort of see it from a new perspective, even if it's just for a moment.
Well, let's hear a little bit example of that performance art in action. It's our guest, Kembrew McLeod, who is professor of communication studies at University of Iowa, but a prankster in his own right. Before we hear this, give us a little bit of background on your freedom of expression lawsuit.
Well, back in 1998, I applied to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to see if they would grant me a trademark for the phrase freedom of expression. It was basically a test to see whether or not, yeah, we live in a world where, you know, intellectual property rights have stretched so far that they would allow someone to privately own freedom of expression. I hoped I didn't live in that world, but it turned out I did, because in 1998 I was granted trademark for that term. And in 2003, when AT&T used that phrase in an ad campaign, I hired a lawyer to send a cease and desist letter to AT&T for using that phrase without my permission. More importantly, I also sent out press release. So the New York Times broke the story, which had the ripple effect of trickling down to wire services and so on. So lots of people basically heard this story. And I think storytelling is a really important part of a good prank. If there's like a good hook, oh, did you hear about the guy who trademarked freedom of expression? That's like a meme that allows my critique, to travel far and wide.
Well, here you are at a press conference for the freedom of expression lawsuit.
You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I spent a lot of time, you know, protecting my trademark and actually, you know, paying the $245 it costs to register for a trademark. And, you know, I guess it comes down to I spent too much time, money, and effort trademarking freedom of expression just to have any joker come along and think they can use it whenever they want.
So who got it and who didn't, I guess, Kembrew? And tell us why that matters.
I was saying earlier about how there has to be an underlying point to a good prank. And so it's not enough just to deceive people. There has to be the big reveal in which you sort of explain yourself afterwards. But just to ensure that everyone who read that story got it, you know, I followed up with, well, writing a book about the subject, op-eds that I wrote about the subject, so that I kind of educated the public in my own kind of quirky way.
Like you said, it starts with a good story, and there's another one that's easily picked up by the media. This is Jimmy Kimmel. I'm not sure if you know about this prank, but the fake twerk fail. Let's hear just a clip from that.
Even though the video was fake, that did not stop hundreds of news outlets from showing it. Some people even blamed Miley Cyrus as if this was her fault. But this is just a sampling of some of the many, many media outlets who fell for our little prank.
For this segment, we thought we just had to trot out this video because apparently it's everywhere.
The first time I saw it, viral video, 2 million views. It now has 8 million.
This girl's foray into twerking ended in near disaster.
I do believe the look on her face is
real. But you know, panic.
Well, it's a good thing nothing is happening in Syria right now. Did you have fun doing this?
So the prank obviously worked, went viral. But how is this different to you, Kimbrew, than making some sort of statement about twerking? You know, why does a prank work where declarations do not?
Well, I mean, it's the same reason why The Daily Show and The Colbert Report are so popular. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of younger people use them as news sources, because you can get away with saying some pretty outrageous things and floating some outrageous ideas when you wrap it in a kind of sugarcoating of humor. And I mean, there's a long tradition of that.
You were talking earlier about a distinction between pranks and hoaxes and cons. I wonder if you've got some examples of hoaxes or cons historically or contemporarily that you think particularly worked.
P.T. Barnum in the mid-19th century is a really interesting figure because he kind of blurred the lines between hoaxing and conning and even pranking, because a lot of his audiences would come to his museum, for instance, or his exhibits, knowing that what they're seeing, like a supposed mermaid, is probably fake. But they gain a certain amount of pleasure trying to decode how they're being tricked. And nowadays, I mean, well, you can look at all sorts of email phishing scams and so on. I mean, those are a very pronounced part of our digital age, and they are part of a con artist tradition that stretches back centuries.
Although many people are wise to those kind of email phishing scam cons, not everybody is. Why do you think it is, Kimbrew, that we are such easy marks for a con? I mean, obviously, it works.
Yeah, I mean, I think people fall for cons and also hoaxes and pranks when it basically confirms their own worldview. So, for instance, there's a website that's devoted to people who read Onion articles straight and then post them to Facebook, and they're disgusted by, for instance, a proposed Planned Parenthood $20 billion abortion megaplex. These people are falling for these obviously satirical articles when it confirms their own deep-seated beliefs.
Your book is quite an academic book in many ways. Do you think that considering pranks or looking at them through a scholarly lens takes any of the fun out of it?
Yeah, I think there's the old adage, to dissect a joke is to kill it. But because I'm interested in the way that pranks can be productive and they can be thought-provoking and they can sharpen our critical skills, yeah, I will confess to treating pranks seriously, and I think we should.
That's Virginia Prescott speaking with Kimbrew McLeod, author of Pranksters, Making Mischief in the Modern World. We've got more on what separates a prank from a hoax and a handy list of some of the best pranks in history. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth continues its April Fool's Day celebration with one of the most notorious scientific hoaxes of the 20th century. We'll dig up the infamous Piltdown Man, and Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Today, we're marking April Fool's Day with a look into pranks, cons, and hoaxes. It's been a century since one of the most notorious scientific hoaxes was presented to the world, and only 61 years since the find was exposed as a fraud. Last year, Virginia sat down with Robert Goodby, archaeologist and associate professor at Franklin Pierce University, to talk about the centennial anniversary of the Piltdown Man.
Well, the Piltdown Man consisted of two pieces of bone, one partially fossilized, that was the very large, modern-looking human cranium. And the second was an extraordinarily primitive ape-like jaw. Now, the two of them were found in a gravel pit in the village of Piltdown in Sussex, England, sort of rattling around with a lot of loose material. And the claim was made that they went together, that the jaw was that belonged to the cranium. And when you put them together, you had the ultimate missing link. You had something that was on the one hand very ape-like, on the other hand, with its big brain, looked like a modern human.
So being a missing link, it was a huge archaeological find, or at least purported to be.
Absolutely. You know, at this time, you know, 1912, when the discovery is made, there is almost nothing in the way of a fossil record for human evolution. Now, science had accepted the idea that humans, like other animals, had evolved, but there was very little evidence to go on. And here you have a fossil that could wrap everything up. Now, there were a couple of problems with it. And one of them was that they didn't actually quite fit together because, as luck would have it, the little pivots or hinges on the top of the jaw, the condyles were broken off, both of them. So the jaw could not be precisely fitted to the skull. And that was a problem for the get-go and raised some skepticism among some of the scientific community.
Well, and there was a reason for that. It didn't go.
It didn't go. Absolutely not. But it took another 40 years to really nail that down.
So what was the Piltdown Man actually, in reality?
Well, the Piltdown Man in reality was an old human. And when I say human, I mean modern human, Homo sapiens, an old human cranium from an adult male with the mandible of a female orangutan.
Okay, so one of these things is not like the other.
Absolutely.
Well, did the revelation of a hoax come quickly? I know you said there were some suspicions, but what was the final indictment or evidence against the hoax?
Well, it did take a while. Now, initially with the discovery, there were quite a few skeptics, including some very prominent people like Sir Arthur Keith, who would go on to become one of the great defenders of Piltdown. But it was really after that a matter of accretion. And one of the nice things about science is that you're supposed to be able to replicate your findings. And after Piltdown had been discovered, there were decades of work done at the site to try and find additional remains led by Arthur Smith Woodward, who was one of the leading scientists supporting Piltdown. And none of them were forthcoming.
Who were the perpetrators here? Was that ever truly identified?
Well, there's been a lot of debate, a lot written about it. I don't think it's that big a controversy, and I don't think it's the most important part of the story. The most obvious perpetrator is the discoverer, a gentleman named Charles Dawson, who was a very respected amateur geologist and paleontologist. And yet after his career was over, turns out to have been the author of numerous fakes and frauds. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of problems with many of his discoveries. A second possible culprit is Martin Hinton. And Hinton was Woodward's assistant at the British Museum and hated his boss. Mm. And after his death, actually in the 1970s, an old chest was found in the attic of the museum with Hinton's initials on it. And inside were a bunch of bones that had been stained and altered very much like the Piltdown fossil.
Oh, and so, I see a mystery novel coming out of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are a couple of obvious culprits, and there are some lesser known people, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle has been mentioned as possibly involved in this. But I think those are your two leading culprits right there.
This was at a time in the early 20th century when Charles Darwin's theories were still fairly new, were being tested, embraced by men of science, as they say. Did this set back the cause or the theory of evolution for those who were studying it and dubious of it in the first place?
I don't really think it had that effect. It certainly set back the study of human evolution and led us down a blind alley for a number of decades. And you have to sort of put it in the context of the time. There was almost nothing to compare it to. There was no fossil record for human evolution mm-hmm. at this point. There had actually been in 1856 a skull discovered in the Neander Valley in Germany, mm-hmm. which gives rise to the name Neanderthals. But even that skull was examined by German scientists, and they went with what they knew. They looked at its odd shape and its sloping forehead and its very primitive nature, and concluded it was probably a Frenchman, and actually said that this was one of the soldiers from the Napoleonic Wars who had died in Germany and wasn't recognized as an important hominid ancestor for decades.
Well, when you hear about or read about those bad guesses, are you so convinced that we're doing it right now? I mean, they were convinced at one point, weren't they?
No, they were. And that's the way science works, and that's, I think, the great triumph in this story is that this fraud did not stand. They were unable to find more of these in England, and meanwhile, Africa, as Darwin had predicted, Africa began producing all sorts of fossils that seemed to reflect early human evolution. And eventually by the early 1950s, they said, let's take another closer look at this Piltdown thing. Then when they did, oh my goodness, you put it under magnification, you can actually see the file marks on the teeth because the teeth had to be filed to make it all fit together. You can see where the chemicals have stained the jaw to make it look older. And so that was discarded. And we moved on to other ideas. And for the most part, those have stood the test of time.
Robert Goodby, I want to sign up for your class. Fascinating talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Virginia is speaking with Robert Goodby, archaeologist and associate professor at Franklin Pierce University, about the Piltdown Man. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia today. We'll continue our April Fool's Day celebration with a profile of a man who's made a living off of crank calls. First, the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. It's April Fool's Day, and we're investigating practical jokes, hoaxes, cons, and now a tradition that was practically a rite of passage growing up, the prank call. Back when having a phone book still mattered, crank calling was as easy as picking up the rotary phone. But between caller ID and unlisted numbers, pranking just isn't as easy nowadays. But that doesn't mean it's completely disappeared. It's just become a little more specialized. Maureen McMurray brings us the story.
Jim Florentine is a stand-up comic, Howard Stern regular, and host of VH1's That Metal Show. If his name doesn't ring a bell, his voice might. He was one of the guys behind Comedy Central's Crank Yankers, you know, that show about the pranking puppets.
Hi, Rich. This is Bobby Fletcher. I'm calling about the job.
What type of sales experience you got?
I've sold everything over the phone.
Name it. You've done it?
Right.
Well, basically what we're doing here, guy, is dealing specifically with, well, not specifically, taxes. Are you burping?
What?
All right, so that's a pretty good example of what Jim Florentine does best. Like any good prank caller, he is unflappable. He lets things get to this extremely awkward point and never breaks character. But it's actually his early work in the years before he got a paycheck from pranking that I find most compelling. When he was living with a bunch of buddies in a small apartment, passing the time between stand-up gigs with an ingenious prank.
I originally started doing prank calls when I was a kid because I was always grounded for being bad. So I was stuck in the house and I had nothing better to do than to pick up the phone and just call people and bother them. So I started that as a little kid, and then it morphed into being a comic years later. And you know, as a comedian, I had a show at like 10 o'clock at night. So I had nothing going on during the day. So whenever a telemarketer would call, I would just sit by my phone and wait for him, you know, to call. And then I would just try to keep him on the phone as long as possible because I had nowhere to go. So I would try to keep him on the phone for like an hour if I could.
Hello?
Hello, James?
Yeah.
I'm giving you a call from credit counselor.
Hello?
Yeah. Hey, dude, you still on the phone?
Yeah, I'm still on the phone.
Okay.
Hello?
All right, do you have a few moments? Or...
Yeah, I have a few moments, yeah.
Yo, you still on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Debt consolidation is a program.
Yeah,
you still on, dude?
Yeah.
You on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you want, I can give you a call back.
No, this is fine, actually. I got to run out to work a little bit, so I'd rather get this over with now. It was what? Developed what?
Debt consolidation is a program.
Yo, you still on? Yeah.
Okay.
Turns out those calls that he made for his own enjoyment to pass the time between stand-up gigs is what wound up putting him on the map. Howard Stern caught wind of his pranks, and Jim put out a 5-volume series of these pranks called Terrorizing Telemarketers. And he made all of these pranks with one thing in mind: keep the telemarketers on the line as long as possible. And keeping them on the line actually wasn't that hard.
And, you know, they just had 10 people in a row going, you know, F you, don't ever call here again. So they finally get somebody on the phone. They're like, wow, somebody's actually listening and I got somebody. So they're excited.
Did you find that there was a typical response that you would get?
Well, my whole thing was, you know, if they were ready to leave, you know, get off the call and say, look, sir, we'll just call you tomorrow or I got to go. Just like my whole thing was, I'm just trying to get the information. I don't know how this works.
This is frustrating.
I'm reading from a strip, and I know exactly what I just stated.
The part right before the debt relief you said, what was that?
We are the exclusive agent.
No.
You're throwing me for loops right here, and that's all that I have stated.
Okay, but you said that one three times. I told you that wasn't it.
Okay, then let me go on to proceed further then.
Okay.
Now, because we are a nonprofit company.
No.
Now, because we are a nonprofit company, we are able to guarantee.
It's not that. No, it's not that part, though. I heard that.
I'm moving on from that.
No.
Well, bye, sir, because you still had to know, and I can't. I'm not taking this from you today.
She hung up.
And that's it. Without cursing, without resorting to threats, Jim simply plays dumb to the point of making the harasser the harassed. It's remarkable and it's hilarious. I laughed the first time I heard it. I still think it's funny. But is it mean? Am I mean for thinking it's funny? Do you ever feel a bit bad for some of these people?
No, because they rip people off. Most of their plans are bogus. You know, they're scams. They're bothering people all the time. They rip off old people constantly. You know, what about the people like, go F you, don't ever call here again, I hate you. You know, that's got to make somebody feel bad on the telemarketer, like, oh, my God, everybody hates me.
Okay, well, maybe he does have a point, but does it even matter? I mean, why does the prankster have to bear the burden of guilt in this scenario? But what happens when the prank goes too far? I mean, even Jim admits he doesn't know where the line is, and his line, it is way different from ours.
Even with the telemarketer calls, you just never know. Like, there was another telemarketer call that went wrong where my credit card company called me up and said, look, we can transfer $10,000 from my credit card into your bank account in case, you know. And I'm like, okay, and I'm listening. I'm like, all right. She goes, and then all of a sudden she goes, you know, in case something comes up, maybe you needed the money. And right away when she said that, I go, oh, you know, that's perfect. Because I just hit this old lady with my car and I got to pay her medical bills.
I just found out I hit that old lady. That hit and run, but...
Oh, well, I hope everything works out all right for you.
Yeah, everything's fine with me. I don't know what's going on with her.
Mm.
Well, she's old.
Now, did you have any other balances out there that you wanted to pay off?
Yeah, because you know what? I'm going to have to pick up this old bag's medical expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman's like, okay. And I'm like, I go, let me go over these bills real quick. Let me see if this works because this might be good. And then I just started making stuff up. I said, yeah, I visited her at the hospital and I knocked her teeth out. So I got to buy her new teeth. How much are new teeth? Like fake teeth. And the woman's actually going over the prices with me over the phone.
We can take care of that for you right now unless you would like me to try you back at a later time.
No. I mean, I'm just trying to figure this all out if you can give me a second.
Okay.
The dentures, what would you say that goes for?
Couldn't tell you how much the dentures will cost.
All right, so the hearing aid is, I don't know, what do you say, $1,000 for two of them, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
$1,500?
Maybe a little bit more than that.
All right, let's go $2,000 with
okay.
it.
Okay.
Finally, at the end of the call, she's like, okay, what's your account number so we can transfer the money? Now, I don't want them to transfer the money, obviously, so now I got to get out of it. So I'm thinking, how can I get out of this? So I just blurted out. I go,
you know what? $7,050 I got to pay for this. I think it's just cheaper to just go kill her. Hello?
Okay. I can admit that probably is a line crossed for most people. I was uncomfortable. But in his defense, I will speak in his defense, I mean, this wasn't planned. And he just said the first thing that came into his mind. And as a professional comedian, sometimes what's on the top of your mind might be dark. I mean, you push boundaries for a living. So what wound up happening here is the woman hangs up the phone. Jim thinks, all right, I got out of that situation. She didn't transfer the money into my account. Everything's good. Prank is a success. And then this happens.
45 minutes later, I got two detectives at my door because it was my credit card company that had my address right in front of them. the woman believed it, that I, you know, that I was going to go kill this woman in a hospital, and that two detectives were knocking on my door, and they, you know, came in and started searching my house and looking in rooms because I thought there was like an old lady's dead body in there. And now I'm trying to explain to them, like, look, I do these prank calls. I work on this show called Crank Anchors, and they had my license. They're looking at it, checking everything out, and the guy just looked at it. He goes, "You're 32 years old. What is wrong with you?"
But here's the thing. Jim's in his 40s now, and he has a wife and a kid, and he's still making prank calls. He's still a stand-up comic, and I bet he still thinks that joke is funny. He'll probably always think that joke is funny. But thank goodness for someone like Jim, because you know what? The prank call, in the way that we knew it as kids, is dead. We have caller ID. We have phone tracking systems. We have unlisted numbers. Those innocent prank calls we made as kids, those don't exist anymore. Maybe a good prank needs someone like Jim Florentine who will say the things that we won't, and we'll go to the places we won't, and we'll go to the lengths that we just won't to get a laugh, all in the name of keeping prank call alive.
Just doing my thing.
Maureen McMurray speaking with professional prankster and stand-up comic Jim Florentine. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott today, and Word of Mouth is celebrating April Fool's Day with, what else, pranks, cons, and hoaxes. As part of its 30 for 30 series, ESPN profiled perhaps the most prolific sports prankster of all time, Barry Bremen. Between 1979 and 1986, Bremen was responsible for over 20 hoaxes in professional sports. Here he is, along with a few former members of the Kansas City Kings, remembering the warm-up layup line at the NBA All-Star Game.
As soon as the door opened to let the players out, I went in with them, and I joined them. And I went up to them, I'm talking to them, and I said, "Fellas, don't be alarmed, I'm not here to hurt you."
He was 6'5", 6'4", 6'5". I mean, he looked like an athlete.
And next thing you know, he's bricking layups, you know, bricking little shots and high-fiving Kareem and Otis Birdsong and Tom Chambers and Jack Sikma.
I couldn't believe I was out there playing with these guys, and here I'm on the floor of the stadium, and I was nervous because I've never ever broken the law. I never did anything semi-exciting like that.
In recognition of Barry's impressive history of imposting, yes, that is a word, Brian Curtis, staff writer for Grantland, compiled a list of memorable practical jokes played in the world of sports. Virginia sat down with Brian to get the stories behind the hoaxes, starting with Barry Bremen.
Bremen pulled off these hoaxes decades ago. Would his antics work now, you know, with 24-hour media coverage and every detail of sports figures tracked?
You would think imposting would be harder now, right, with the increased security and, as you say, the kind of digital scrutiny that all these things get. But, you know, just not so long ago, a very famous Notre Dame linebacker had a girlfriend out in somewhere on the West Coast who didn't exactly exist, right? And while that's not exactly, you know, the kind of hoax we're talking about, these things still can slip through. So I think, you know, with a determined prankster, sure, yeah, there's plenty of potential there.
What makes a great sports hoax?
I think a great sports hoax is one in which you sort of go in with a very, very specific plan and you exploit something that either the owners or the writers of the sporting world are looking for. For instance, if you want, you know, if they're looking for great stories of rookie phenoms, maybe that's how you slip in. Or maybe, you know, they're looking for sort of the old Cinderella thing, the team that comes out of nowhere. And you exploit that and you slip right in and, you know, you pull a fast one on everybody, I guess.
I guess that's red meat for sports writers. Give us another example of the Cinderella phenomenon.
Well, there was this, Dick Enberg was one of the great sportscasters for NBC and CBS. And back in the 70s, he decided it would be really funny during his college basketball broadcast if he invented a team called the Wyoming State Porcupines. This sounds totally ridiculous, right? The Porcupines. They might have even been the Fighting Porcupines. But, you know, we watch the NCAA tournament every year. We love the Cinderellas. And so every couple of weeks at halftime, he would mention the undefeated Wyoming State Porcupines and how they were climbing up the rankings. Now, no one had ever seen this team play, and it might have been curious that they never were actually in the NCAA tournament if they were undefeated year after year after year. But he pulled it off for 2 years, and writers were calling by the end and asking, geez, you know, do you have any context over there? I'd love to do a story on the Fighting Porcupines.
Another story and another prank. The baseball world met 36-year-old Richard Pohl. What was his prank?
Richard was 36 years old, as you say, and totally washed out as a baseball player. He wasn't any good. Nobody was going to sign him. But he realized that if he had his same skill set as a 21-year-old baseball player, that maybe he would have a chance. So he fashioned himself as Rocky Perrone from Australia. And the pokes went all the way to him wearing a shaggy Pete Rose hairpiece, a Dutch boy painter's cap, and teaching himself 70s dugout chatter so that he would do it. And the really the ingenious touch of this is when he was going around and auditioning in front of scouts, he knew that no 21-year-old would know how to bunt. That was like an old man's skill. Mm-hmm. So he pretended to not know how to bunt, and that sort of did the ruse. In fact, the Padres wind up signing Rocky Perrone, as it were, and he managed to get a couple of bats in Class A ball before someone finally recognized him.
Another great trick proving that you can't, if you can't fake a winning team, just fake an award. Give us this rundown at students at the College of William & Mary.
This was truly ingenious. 1972 at William & Mary, there's a number of, I think, four undergrads who see all these All-America teams coming out in the newspaper, and they're sort of amused by this. And they say, what would it take to just make up a completely phony All-America team? So they cook up an organization called the, quote, National Association of Collegiate Basketball Writers. We're giving out an award called the Hirschberger, named after a fictional New York sports writer, long deceased, of course, by the time the award comes out. They cook up phony letterhead. I really appreciated this touch. It said, serving the sport, you know, on the letterhead. This is this organization of very self-important sports writers. Anyway, they just came up with the list themselves, making sure to include a William & Mary player on the list, sent it out to all the winners, as it were, and newspapers, and it ran on the AP wire, and they maintained it for a couple of years. And one of them later went to Notre Dame and saw the Hirschberger, this phony award hanging on the wall of the athletic department.
That is so good. 40 years this goes on. Brian, if somebody wanted to play a sports hoax, do you think that there are some sports that are easier to infiltrate than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think in that respect, college, you know, it's harder, I suppose. You know, the NFL is hyper-organized, mm-hmm. professional, you know. I mean, I suppose you could slip on a field or slip into some minor role, but maybe, you know, that would be difficult, I think. College sports is so diffuse, right, so spread out all over the country and so run by so many fiefdoms, not just the NCAA, but the various writers giving out awards at the BCS, the various conferences, that I think that would actually be the easiest. Because, like I said, you know, like these guys figured out, you know, who actually knows what's behind any of these awards? Mm. And, you know, why not just sort of come up with one on your own? So, yeah, I think college would probably be your best bet.
Well, Brian Curtis, staff writer for Grantland, may a Hirschberger Award be somewhere in your future.
My dream would truly come true. Thank you.
And you can see a list, Brian's full list of 7 terrific sports hoaxes online. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter.
Stay with us. Our April Fool's Day show continues with a look at the long con when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
Today on Word of Mouth, we have been celebrating April Fool's Day with a deeper look into pranks, practical jokes, and hoaxes, and we wrap up with the mother of all deception, the con. But what sets a con apart from a hoax? Is it a desire for monetary gain, or perhaps an innate desire to deceive? And what role do we play in the con? To find out more about the intricate art and history of the con, we go to a conversation Virginia had with Amy Reading, author of The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con.
Well, let's go to the art of the con, which plays on some of the softest spots of human nature. But it was the term invented in America. Is it particularly an American phenomenon, the confidence trick?
Certainly, Americans have been fascinated with con artists for our entire history. I think you can see it as a kind of further evolution of another mythical figure in our culture, which is the self-made man. Mm. The con artist just takes that one step further and invents absolutely everything about himself. But I would point out that it's not only American. There are other nations and other cultures that are fascinated with this figure, and I think the thing that they all have in common is that they're market cultures. And it does stretch back, you know, as far back as early modern Europe, when this question of attaining the price of something, attaining the value of something, became a question of cultural importance, and that stretched even to the value of a person and who is the person that's standing in front of you.
And the very origins of this republic, founding father Thomas Jefferson had a strong distaste for speculation or a market based on anything but actual goods and services or debt. That was a prime target of Benjamin Franklin. Risk and debt, you know, both at the heart of American capitalism. How did they play into the confidence trick?
Originally, you're right, Jefferson and Franklin were very much in favor of labor and earning what you spend from what you grow and having everything be local networks of trade. And this was a very hard-fought debate at that time, and they essentially lost, although it took a long time, well into the 19th century, before we had a federal bank and a central banking system based on federally issued debt that you can buy and sell and trade. And all of this was seen as a way to encourage speculation and encourage people to make fortunes based on nothing, to trade paper rather than to grow crops and to transport them over local networks of trade. But once you've got fortunes that exist only on paper, then you can counterfeit them. You can trade them in all sorts of different ways that manipulate the value there. Then you're dealing with a system of trade that's based on trust. And it's based on authority and the markers of those authority, which is very different from looking at a bushel of wheat and weighing it and coming up with a price.
Before there was a national currency, there was exchanging banknotes. It was sort of like exchanging an IOU. So how did confidence men take advantage of that?
Oh, every possible way you can imagine. So each bank would issue essentially its own currency, and it would all look very, very different. And therefore, it was extremely easy to counterfeit because one person couldn't possibly memorize every single banknote and every single signifier of authority. So people would counterfeit notes, and then in order to address this problem, other people would publish counterfeit detectors, which would reproduce what the actual note from each bank looked like so that you could pull out a bill from your wallet and hold it up to the counterfeit detector and see if the note that you're holding in your hand matches. And if it matches, then you've got an actual note and not a fake one. But, of course, then you can just go ahead and counterfeit the counterfeit detector. And
I love that.
You keep spinning the wheel and manipulating the signs of authority. And so there's no bottom. It's this sort of infinite regress. And this is a huge problem at a time when, you know, no one in the North would know banks from the South and vice versa. The country was very far apart in terms of cultural and geographic distance.
In a way, it's just American ingenuity at work, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And you know what? We have always kind of admired con men. We condemn them and we don't want to be their victims. Yet we hold them up as cultural heroes in a lot of our stories and our myths because they're clever and because they see opportunities where other people don't. They're entrepreneurs, really. And they are very good at making use of the disparity between the laws and the opportunities that exist where laws have not yet moved in. And that's called, you know, just plain old good business sense. So it can sometimes be hard to keep in mind that, oh, no, they're actually criminals, but they're very good ones. They're very smart.
But what's interesting about all these cons throughout history that you detail is using the tools, technologies, and norms of the time, right? The railroads, for example, provided an escape for people. And in this time of criminal masterminds, taking advantage of even wiretapping. Now, this I found fascinating. How did swindlers get into intercepting messages?
Well, so first, swindlers actually did intercept wiretaps from racetracks. This is a kind of gambling swindle where they would intercept the results of a horse race before it got to a betting parlor, delay it by just a few minutes so then they could place bets on the actual winning horse and then relay the results. And what do you know? They won. So they did this for a while and made lots of money and made lots of pool room and saloon operators much poorer. But then, as swindlers do, they turned it around once again and made it a little bit deeper. They began selling, if you will, the idea of tapping racing betting parlors, and where they didn't even have to tap the wires anymore. They could pretend they could have a set with all these complicated boxes and wires and dials where it looked like they were tapping the racetracks, and they would then persuade a mark that they had this incredible technology, this money-making mechanism, and they would get the mark to invest on setting up a betting parlor where they could take money from other marks through this magical means. And these dials and wires would lead nowhere. It was all just a front. But they had proven in the past, by actually tapping racetracks, that they could do it. So there was no reason for a mark not to invest in the idea of perpetrating this con on other people. So you just see how the swindlers can take each idea they have and take it one step further.
Virginia speaking with Amy Reading, author of The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con. Well, we've covered pranks, hoaxes, and cons. Looks like our April Fool's Day coverage is over, but the day isn't. So watch your back, your shoelaces, your desk, your toothpaste, and so on. And we want to hear from you. What's the most epic prank you've pulled? If you pranked someone today or became the unwitting victim of an April Fool's Day joke, join the conversation that's happening right now on our Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Join Word of Mouth for more stories of curiosity, intrigue, and perhaps a little mischief tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.